Hi guys, this is Betty Wild from Monsters and Mothers. If this is your first time here to the show, we have recently moved to anchor.com. If you would like to subscribe to all 5 seasons, please click the link in the bio or visit me at monstersandmothers.com.
As little girls and boys, we look up at the glowing angel that gave us life with love and adoration. But for too many, this is not a happy reality. For many, the woman holding us is a true monster. These are their nightmares. Delve deep as we unravel the turbulent bonds between mother and child. You are listening to Monsters and Mothers with your host, Betty Wild.
Hi, true crime family. This is Betty Wild coming to you from Monsters and Mothers. These cases just get wilder and wilder. Let's get into it. Jim and Naomi Olive were an adorable couple. Naomi was a real-life beauty queen, and Jim, a senior executive in the oil industry. The couple lived the life. And they did so in Norfolk, Virginia. As perfect as life seemed, they thought that they could hear the baby bells chiming. So they did what most of us believe completes us. They wanted to expand their family and decided to try to have a baby. But after several attempts, they realized that having a child may not be in the cards for them. The two had contemplated adoption, but hearing the stories of adoptions gone wrong, they decided that they were willing to take a risk to make their lives more complete. So, after receiving the devastating news that Naomi was unable to conceive, they decided to adopt. In 1959, they brought home a newborn baby girl who had been given up at birth by her unwed mother. They named the little girl Marlene, and she was the center of their universe. 3 years later, Jim and Naomi moved with their new family to Ecuador after accepting a job with another oil company. Here, the new family enjoyed an even grander lifestyle with a large villa and an army of servants. Marlene had grown to be a delightful toddler who had developed a close bond with her adoptive father. However, the cracks in their perfect life would begin to appear. Marlene's relationship with her mother was becoming strained. Left alone for long periods of time due to her husband's demanding work hours, Naomi began to drink and was already showing signs of mental illness that would plague her for the rest of her life. When Naomi was drunk, which was quite often, she'd take out all her frustrations on her daughter, screaming at her, taunting her, making fun of her real mother, who Naomi had claimed had been a prostitute. The abuse continued as Marlene grew up, and eventually Marlene started fighting back. Mother and daughter were often at each other's throats. In 1973, Jim lost his job and announced to his family that they would be moving back to the United States. To Marlene, who was now 13, this spelled disaster. Everything she knew was in Ecuador, and she loved it there. She was desperate to stay. She had heard the nightmare stories of teens in the U.S. that were negative. Marlene was a good girl who did well in school. In fact, she prided herself on it and didn't want to turn out like her real mother. But still, in 1973, the family moved to Marin County, California. Jim, no longer the wealthy tycoon with a corporate salary, knew that a go-getter like himself, that this was just a minor setback. He quickly acquired a partner and set up business that offered consulting services. That, of course, took a serious chunk of his time. Perhaps that is why he appears to have been blissfully unaware of the deepening resentment now growing between Naomi, and Marlene. He was even clueless that the fights between the mother and daughter had now grown to be physical. Marlene began spending more and more time away from home. Done being the good girl, Marlene ran in the other direction. Seeking attention from the wrong crowd, she found a group of teenagers that were known for doing drugs and for sleeping around. Soon, the 14-year-old was experimenting with marijuana, cocaine, LSD, and was also having sex and skipping school in order to sneak off to rock concerts. Marlene then started to practice witchcraft and would boast to her friends that she was a member of the Church of Satan. Marlene also developed her skills as a liar/storyteller. One of Marlene's most outrageous stories was that she was telling people that she had appeared in a porn movie as a child while living in South America, and she would also tell people that her father was an important man in the Ecuadorian drug trade. Marlene decided to start dressing the part as well, so she decided to dress like a porn star. She wore micro skirts, platform heels, her face packed on with makeup, her hair dyed rainbow colors. She gained the reputation of being easy. The fears she expressed to her father about leaving Ecuador appeared to have been a self-fulfilling prophecy. Then, before Marlene could even see the wall coming, she slammed straight into Chuck Riley. Remember now, it was 1974, and Chuck was a local drug dealer. He was your typical high school dropout, who also had a little bit of a weight problem. So not surprisingly single, since the man-child left much to be desired, and the only thing he did have going for himself was that he was the drug hookup. And that was how he met Marlene. After their first meeting, he came to the conclusion that he was madly in love with Marlene. And Marlene at first gagged Chuck's clumsy advances. He was already considered a joke by most of the cool kids that Marlene hung out with. But eventually, after several months, his persistence wore her down, and she agreed to go out with him. Maybe it was the free drugs he gave her, or perhaps it was the expensive gifts that he was always showering her with. But nevertheless, Marlene took full advantage of her power over Chuck. She could manipulate him to her will. She allowed him to have sex with her. But also, she began pushing this sexually naive Chuck to do more and more extreme things. She even had him take explicit photos of her, which she said she was going to send to Penthouse magazine. After this, things grew weirder and Marlene was out of control. This once good girl was now being called Cringe Girl when she made Chuck wear a leather mask and whip her. And that wasn't even the cringiest thing. Marlene would masturbate with Chuck's gun and urinate on his face in front of several friends that just stood there watching. If Chuck ever wavered, she reminded him that she was going to cast a spell on him that would make him her slave. And apparently, he believed anything Marlene told him. Chuck's relationship with Marlene had a distinct impact on his personality. Whereas before, he'd been the loser, eager to please and the butt of all the jokes. He, now more of a force, lost weight and began dressing more fashionably, more in style. He also started carrying a gun. Now, to Marlene's parents, though, he was just the kind of positive influence she needed in her life. But little did they know what Marlene had just asked him to do. Around them, he was always polite and respectful. Her parents were happy to give their blessing. Marlene and Chuck smiled at her parents all while Marlene was planning her parents' murder. Marlene was tired of her mother's constant blowouts and never-ending insults, tired of her father, never home, and always looking the other way. She blamed him for not backing her up in the fights with Naomi. And things finally came to a head in March 1975. Chuck and Marlene were arrested for shoplifting. Even though there were no charges brought up against them, Marlene's parents had decided that they had enough and they were going to send her away. He also told Marlene that she was no longer allowed to see Chuck again. Marlene, of course, was not having that, and she snuck out to see him anyway. During those meetings, she told him that he was going to lose her if he didn't do something now. Marlene did whatever it took to get Chuck to fold, even telling him that he could take over Jim's supposed South American drug empire once he was gone. And she also issued her usual threats. If Chuck did not get rid of her parents, she was going to break up with him. Now, Chuck Riley was placed in an impossible position. He loved Marlene with all his heart and could not imagine his life without her. He'd once attempted suicide when she told him that she was ending her relationship with him. Now, he stood to lose her again. And on Saturday, June 21st, 1975, Chuck acted. On that day, Chuck had been doing so much acid, and he was doing this for several days in a row. He was so spaced out that he could barely even walk. Several people saw him that morning stumbling through Terralinda neighborhood on his way to show the love of his life, how deeply and utterly committed he was to her. No one noticed the gun tucked into his waistband under his shirt. Marlene and her father were not at home when Chuck arrived, so he entered through an unlocked door and headed for the upstairs bedroom where Naomi could always be found, drunk and unconscious in her bed. Chuck had picked up a hammer that he found on a sideboard. He lifted it, held it above, pausing before he brought it down with all his might. The blow was delivered with such force that he penetrated Naomi's skull, and the hammer became lodged inside her head. Chuck had to press down with his hand on her head in order to wriggle it free. Then he raised it up again and brought it down repeatedly. He was so shocked that Naomi still wasn't dead. She lay on the bed with her skull a bloody mess of bone shards, blood, and brain matter. Blood was spewing everywhere, even out of her mouth. And before he could even take another blow, he heard the sound of a vehicle drawing to a stop outside. Jim and Marlene were back. Chuck had to think fast. He decided that his best bet was just to confront Marlene and her dad. He rushed down the stairs and hid behind the couch, holding the pistol close to him. When Marlene and her dad entered the house, Jim had already spotted Chuck hiding and demanded to know what was going on. When Chuck stood up, his face was covered in blood and brain matter. "What have you done?" Jim demanded. He lunged for Chuck, and Chuck raised the pistol and fired four times, killing Jim on the spot. Chuck and Marlene would spend the rest of the day cleaning up after the crime scene. When they were done, they loaded the bodies into the family station wagon and drove to China Camp State Park, where they incinerated her parents in a barbecue pit. The fire attracted a lot of questions, and a call was made to the fire department. Firefighters noticed bones among the ashes, but thought that they might belong to a deer. Jim and Naomi no longer existed, and their dreams of completing their lives by welcoming a child into their homes was now shattered. The house was now filled with parties that their killers were throwing, all before their ashes even cooled. Over the following week, the teenage killers lived together in the death house. They were hardly discreet about their actions, going on spending sprees with their credit cards, and even inviting friends over to do drugs, and they also attended a rock concert by the band Yes. During this concert, Marlene is heard suddenly chanting, "I killed my parents, I killed my parents," over and over again, getting progressively louder. But hardly anyone could hear her over the sound of the band, and those who did took her admission of guilt as a joke. But they would soon face the music, and this time it wasn't at a concert. After trying for several days to contact Jim, his business partner eventually reported him missing to the police, and a patrol car was dispatched to see what was in fact going on over at that house. The police were met with a very not convincing Marlene, and by her demeanor and the way the house looked, they were sketched out enough to bring her to the station for further questioning. Marlene told several different stories under interrogation. First, she said that her parents had gone to Lake Tahoe for a break. Then she said that Jim had killed Naomi and fled. Then it was Naomi who was the killer. Finally, she was like, fuck it, and admitted to them that, yes, she was the dark seed they thought she was. She took Chuck along in her burning ship. And Chuck was arrested that same day and quickly cracked under interrogation, confessing to the murders but insisting that Marlene had cast a spell on him and made him do it. Both Chuck and Marlene were charged with the so-called barbecue murders. But as juvenile, she was never going to do hard time. The sentence, when it came, was a mere 2 years in juvenile hall. Chuck, meanwhile, had been tried, found guilty, and sentenced to death. Chuck, now in his 50s, remains incarcerated to this day. And as for Marlene, she served part of her sentence at the Ventura School before being released to live under supervised care. But while on parole, she fled to New York City, where she worked for some time as a prostitute, before being arrested again and sent back to California to finish her sentence. She was released in 1980 at the age of 21. Since then, Marlene Olive had been in and out of trouble with the law, serving several prison terms for forgery, drug-related charges, and even prostitution. She and Chuck only saw each other once more when she visited him in prison in 1981. Not all good things come wrapped in a blanket. Some darlings sour. I am your host, Betty Wild, and thank you for listening to Monsters and Mothers.
Thank you for listening to Monsters and Mothers. Subscribe to hear more chilling accounts of mothers who commit unspeakable horrors.